Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Ruth Richardson. She's the Executive Director of Global Alliance for the Future of Food. And I'll tell you more about that in just a little bit when she comes on. But first, I want to share some things going on in and around the news with you and some events going on that you might want to participate on coming up. So first off, this evening, up at Stone Barns at Blue Hill, there is a beer tasting going on. And Stone Barns, for those of you who don't know, is a wonderful restaurant up at Blue Hill is a wonderful restaurant up at Stone Barns, which is an agricultural educational center in Tarrytown, New York, that is doing wonderful, wonderful things for the environment. It's a great learning center, and the restaurant is just exquisite. So if you want to taste beer in a really wonderful environment with some great tasty bites, that's the place to go. And then on Friday, there's a nature art gallery opening at the North Shore Land Alliance, which is out at the Planting Fields Arboretum in Long Island. And it's a beautiful, beautiful arboretum. And the North Shore Land Alliance is really doing a lot of great work in our area where I live to save open protected land. So this is an art opening they're having there. And they're also supporting a winter bird walk in Sag Harbor on Sunday, March 4th, that you might want to participate in. And the sixth annual Massachusetts Urban Farming Conference is coming up in Boston on Friday, March 16th through Saturday, March 17th. You might want to participate in that. And save the date for the New York City Vegetarian Food Festival coming up in May, May 19th and 20th, but you have plenty of time to wait for that. Green Thumb Growers Conference is coming up right away, though, March 31st. That's at the Borough of Manhattan Community College, and that's celebrating the 40th anniversary of New York City Green Parks. And that should be a good conference. I've never gone to it yet, but I'm hoping to make this one. And some things going on in and around the news. Well, you know, it's really wonderful to see all these young people coming together to fight for gun regulations. But it doesn't seem to be going the way that I would hope that it goes. The idea of Trump paying teachers to get a bonus to carry a firearm just does not make sense to me. And it's quite disturbing, and I just don't know really what to make of it. You know, but it's wonderful to see so many students coming together. There's going to be a big march at the end of this month. I think it's March 24th. You should save the date for that. I think it's going to be happening all across the country in capitals everywhere for young people and everybody to come out onto the streets and support gun regulation. So I know that's not really about food, but it is about our children, and it's just so, so important. But I want to share with you a piece of journalism that came out. It was an investigation by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and they found that in the U.S., over 14.7% of the population is estimated to get a foodborne illness, compared to 1.5% in the U.K. So here we're talking about 48 million people in the United States versus 1 million in the U.K. And, you know, the foodborne illness is coming because of the lack of regulations, the lack of people checking out the sites where the meats are being processed. I mean, this report is just shocking. You know, it talks about, well, it's not really shocking stuff that I know, but they talk about fecal matter in the meat. They talk about grease and blood on the equipment. They talk about chicken dropping on the floor and just rinsing it with chlorine and putting it back in the production line. I mean, it just goes on and on. And so I will have a petition on my website that I really encourage you all to sign on to send a message to Costco to ask them to stop supporting this kind of factory farming and also to encourage more regulation. You know, and meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is recommending that we all eat 2 to 3 cups of vegetables per day. And yet, if everybody really tried to do that, we don't even grow enough vegetables. And that's partly because of our lovely farm bill, which is coming up again for reauthorization. And I ask everybody to let your representatives know that you want to support a farm bill that supports sustainable agriculture, that supports our small and middle farmers who are really trying to do the right thing. If they're not already organic, they're trying to transition to it. But instead, our farm bill subsidizes all the growing of soy and corn that is not for food, but it's for, you know, biofuel and fertilizers and all this other stuff. So we really need to put our priorities in line and support the things that are important to us. And the Farm Bill is one. The Farm Bill also is the piece of legislation that supports SNAP, which used to be called food stamps, but it's a supplemental nutrition assistance program. And it is really, it really needs to be supported. There are just too many people in this country that are still hungry, and food is a right. Food should not be a luxury. Access to good, healthy food is really something that everybody needs. It just affects everyone on every level, and we really need to start looking at the root causes of hunger, which is poverty, and the lack of equality in pay scales and raises and what we value. We have a lot of work to do, and I call upon all of us to really show up and stand up and do what we need to do to move regulation and legislation in the right direction so that we have a country that we want to be proud to be a part of. Before I forget, I want to let you all know that thanks to Audio Now, the Progressive Radio Network now has an app, and you can go to your cell phone onto the App Store, and you can actually download the Progressive Radio Network app. And that way you can listen to my show and all the shows on PRN from your car, anywhere you are, old shows in the archives or listen live. But it's a wonderful new app, so I encourage you all to get it. And now I'd like to share with you my recipe. Last week I had Bren Smith on, who is the director of Green Wave, which is a wonderful coalition, or not a coalition, a wonderful new organization that's supporting 3D ocean farming. And it's vertical farming in the ocean. And it was really exciting. And he was talking about seaweeds and how we really all need to expand our palate to eat more seaweed instead of just only fish from the oceans. And that's just so healthy. And so it inspired me to make a new seaweed dish. So I used arame just because that's what I had in the house, but you could use tzatziki or some other seaweed. And I'm really going to try to expand my knowledge about seaweeds, because there's thousands of edible plants in the ocean, and I'm familiar with a lot more than most, but there's so many more. So I will be exploring that and sharing that with you. But this was what I used for this recipe was arame, but you could use tzatziki or another seaweed that you have. And you need to first open the seaweed package. It comes dried, so you're going to pour some boiling water over it and just let it stand for 15 minutes to reconstitute it and to get it soft again. And meanwhile, you're going to saute, well, first I'm going to give you the ingredients. So it's 2 cups of arame, 2 parsnips, 3 carrots, 1 large onion, 4 tablespoons of tamari, 2 tablespoons of mirin, 2 tablespoons of ginger grated, 2 tablespoons of garlic grated, 2 cups of Brussels sprouts that I then shredded or cut, you know, really fine, 1 tablespoon of dark sesame oil, that's 1 teaspoon of dark sesame oil, and 1 tablespoon of chopped cilantro and 1/4 cup of pumpkin seeds. And so while the seaweed is soaking, I sauteed the onions in my cast iron frying pan for about 5 minutes. Then I added the carrots and the parsnips along with the garlic and ginger and kept sauteing that for another 5 minutes or so. Then I drained the seaweed, reserving some of the water, because you can add that for the into the saute to make it a little softer. So save that water. But then you're going to put the drained seaweed into the skillet. Put about a quarter cup of that saved water in there. Add the Brussels sprouts and the tamari and the mirin, and just mix all that up and then cover it and let it simmer for about 10 to 15 minutes. And check it. If you need to add a little bit more of the seaweed water, you can do that. You can add, you know, you can add the tamari according to your taste. So instead of putting all 4 tablespoons in at once, I start with 2 and then taste it and add more if I need to. And so you can adjust it for taste that way. And then at the very end, I added the pumpkin seeds and the cilantro. And I saved a little cilantro for garnish. And as you know about cilantro, some people don't like cilantro. And if you are one of those people, you just leave it out. You can put in parsley instead if you'd like. And this is a great side dish. If you want to saute some tofu and add tofu to this, you can, and it becomes a full meal. And that's it. So I hope you all enjoy that. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week. Ruth Richardson is the Executive Director of the Global Alliance for the Future of Food, which is a unique coalition of foundations committed to leveraging their resources to help shift food and agriculture towards greater sustainability, security, and equity. And Ruth brings, you know, years of philanthropic work to this role, and I'm going to let her tell you more about the Global Alliance for the Future of Food. Ruth, are you with me?
I am. Thank you, Bhavani.
Sure. So can you first just start by letting my listeners know what the Global Alliance for the Future of Food is and where you're located? Because I know you're in Canada mostly, right?
Well, yeah, so the Global Alliance for the Future of Food is a strategic alliance of about 25 international foundations that are predominantly located in the U.S. and Europe, although they do have funding programs around the world. We are a virtual organization, so I'm based in Toronto, Canada. However, our foundations are all over the map, as are the staff. And then, of course, we have connections to all the amazing groups that our foundations fund, again, across the globe.
Uh-huh. And what do you work towards?
So we came together about 5 years ago because there was a kind of collective feeling, understanding, and perspective that our current food systems are not serving us well. They're not delivering health. They're not building our economies in the way that they could and should. They're not benefiting farmers. They're not respecting the planet. So there was a real sense that, you know, our food systems are not doing what we need them to do for us. And then we're not taking advantage of all the positive benefits that food systems can bring to the planet. So with that kind of, you know, sense of the problem, these foundations came together to think about how we might collectively push food systems towards greater security, sustainability, and equity. And, you know, we spent some time, of course, getting to know each other, understanding the different interests. The foundations that make up the Global Alliance are extremely diverse in terms of where they come at the issues. So some of them are more interested in biodiversity, some more focused on public health, some more focused on women farmers, for example. And so there's a lot of sort of establishing our understanding of the issues and then figuring out what we could do together that would add value to this broad landscape where so many people are doing so many amazing things. And essentially what we do, we focus on a strategy that has sort of 3 pillars. One is that we aim to forge new insights and strengthen the evidence for sustainable food systems. So this is all about the research and tools, understanding food systems in their entirety, and, you know, sort of all the, you know, intellectual inputs that we need to make sure that we know what we're talking about. The second pillar of the strategy then is to really try to convene key food system actors and facilitate meaningful dialogue. We truly believe that in order to get where we need to go, we have to bring the various stakeholders across sectors and geographies together to have the difficult conversations that we need to have. So that's a really important emphasis of ours. And then the third pillar of our strategy is really then from there to stimulate local and global action for transformational change. And so this includes being a voice on the global stage for sustainable food systems. And it also means really kind of informing our own foundation members' work at the local level to create changes wherever they happen to be working, if it's at a state level or a national level or a regional level.
Wow, it's a lot, right?
It's a lot.
It's so much. I'm like, you know, I don't know where to start. When you bring, you know, how do you even get so many different, if you bring all the different stakeholders together, I'm assuming you're talking, when you say all the stakeholders, it's not everybody that believes in sustainable, or is it? Are your members people that already believe in, you know, organic and sustainable and regenerative agriculture to support the system, or do you also have, you know, the industrial agricultural farmers or businesses, and then the big food corporations that are, you know, that are really committed to promoting GMOs and that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So within the Global Alliance, as I said, there's a great diversity in the membership. And they all work at different scales and on different things. But what we did early on in order to create that kind of common understanding is we developed a set of six principles that all members of Global Alliance have to sign on to and have to believe in and promote. And so those principles are health, diversity, equity, resilience, renewability, and interconnectedness. And we have, you know, there's obviously a lot more that goes behind each of those words, but those are the principles that we believe in, that we believe need to be reflected in our food systems. And what we say is they're a set, they're not a menu. You can't choose the ones you like or that are the easiest to move forward. You have to take them as a set because it is a system and it's all interdependent. So that's within the Global Alliance. And so we do have this set of common principles, although people have different ways of interpreting them and different ways of applying them to their work. In terms of who we're trying to engage, then that becomes a much bigger tent. And, you know, of course, the other stakeholders don't necessarily ascribe to our principles, but what we feel is we have to have these conversations across perspectives and opinions if we're going to get anywhere. And so we are interested in engaging everybody from La Via Campesina and, you know, a social, large social movement that represents farmers and smallholders, all the way to big corporate players who have a very different perspective on things. But we're not going to really advance global food systems transformation if we're just talking amongst those that have, you know, the same perspective and opinion as us. We really have to reach across the aisle and have those broader discussions.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are the people we need to convince that that there's a better way.
Yeah.
So, so what do you see? What does the Global Alliance for the Future of Food see as their key opportunities for meeting those goals? The future of food, sustainable, secure, and equitable.
Yeah. So again, when we first came together, we did a lot of sort of soul searching in terms of where we see those opportunities. The group identified, you know, a number, 9, 10, 11, 12 areas where there was common interest and common understanding. But essentially, in conversation with other folks and you know, sort of experts in the field, as well as the own sort of intelligence and experience of our membership, we identified three areas that we really wanted to focus on in particular. The first one is true cost accounting, and I can tell you more about that, but that's basically about the economics of the food system. We feel that's a real kind of leverage point. The second is agroecology, and so really elevating sort of the practice and the voice of agroecology and sort of agriculture based on ecological principles and the human right to food. And then the third one is health and well-being. And in that area, we feel that there's a lot of work to be done and a lot of potential in elevating the connection between health and our food systems, which may sound obvious, but in fact, out there, it's not a connection that's being made. And so we feel that those three areas are the principal areas where we can really try to make change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure, you know, you've been seeing the same articles I'm seeing of, you know, the obesity rates around the world, especially in the less developed countries, that it's just skyrocketing. And, the malnourishment that used to be because people didn't have enough food is still there. It's just they're having the wrong foods that are just making them fat and sick and not helping them at all as far as getting healthier.
I was just going to tell you a little story just that came up in my mind as you were saying that. I was asked to speak at the big U.S. Childhood Obesity Conference in San Diego a couple years ago, and I'm not an expert on childhood obesity by any means, but I was asked to talk about, again, this connection between health and food systems. So I was sitting there in front of, you know, an audience of, you know, 2,000 highly educated people in this field, doctors, nurses, people that run lunch programs, you know, sort of within the U.S. school system, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I made the case that, you know, children are not obese because they eat, you know, too many donuts or drink too much Coke. And, of course, that's a contributing factor. But in essence, if you step back, children are obese and have increasingly high obesity rates because of what we grow, where we grow it, how we process it, how we distribute it, how we market it, how we price it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole system. And I was amazed to see how many people had never heard this message before, who had never thought about this before. My doctors coming up to me afterwards, sort of with their jaw on the ground, saying, I had no clue. I never thought about that. So, you know, making these connections is just so critically important, especially as you say, we see these, you know, skyrocketing health impacts as well as the costs associated with those impacts.
Mm-hmm. But the thing that always amazes me is when you see these articles come out and then you'll see, you know, the top executive from Pepsi or Coke or, you know, Nestle, you know, just saying, well, it's not because of what we do. We actually have this, you know, and they list how many products they have that have lower fat and lower sugar, this and that. And then you go and find that those are not the products, though, that are being sold in those countries. And, you know, and they just aren't the ones that have the, you know, the bright marketing and the appeal. So, you know, it just seems like nobody wants to take that responsibility, the companies that are mm-hmm. pushing these foods, and as you said, how it's all connected going all the way down the line to how we market it and how we subsidize it and how we promote it. Who's making those connections? I'm sure you are, but how are we getting mm-hmm. those connections out, and how is your organization helping to do that?
Yeah, thank you. So I think one of the areas, if I can go back to those sort of three areas that we focus on, true cost accounting, agroecology, and health and well-being, I think the answer to your question is really around the true cost accounting. I mean, it's relevant across all three of those. But in this whole area of the economics of the food system, we're deeply engaged in trying to understand the real costs of, you know, various products, commodities, food systems, you know, you name it, it's a whole area that I think has a ton of potential to move us towards more sustainable security and equity. So what we're doing is looking at the true cost of food. So in the past until now, we've mostly seen the cost of a few things, labor, you know, subsidies, taxes, and we've mostly preferenced yields and profit. But in fact, if you take any product, take a fast food hamburger, and you look at the real costs, what you don't see, what's invisible, are all the costs associated with environmental impacts like soil loss or greenhouse gas emissions. You have all the healthcare costs that we're paying for somewhere. We're just not paying for them in the price of that hamburger. So you've got, you know, costs of diabetes, obesity, you know, heart attack, stroke, farm worker exposure to toxic chemicals, you name it. And then there's also a whole bunch of kind of social and cultural costs. So you're looking at local economies or the displacement of indigenous people from palm oil plantations. And so we're looking at all of those environmental costs and developing a framework. It's called TEAG AgriFood. It's a framework that will allow us to apply framework to policies or to a particular farm or to a commodity like corn, and make visible what all of those costs are so that we have the full picture, so we can then make better decisions about the kind of food systems we want to support. And this is relevant, we think, particularly to companies who are having to make these decisions, to policymakers who are having to really define where subsidies go and what sorts of systems they're going to support, you know, through various legislative mechanisms, et cetera, within the countries, and for farmers who are making real decisions on the ground in terms of the kind of production practices they want to put in place. So we feel this has a ton of potential. It's gaining more and more interest and momentum. So companies are picking it up, farmers are picking it up, you know, people are actually trying to do this. And one of the key tools we feel for this will be this Teabag of Food framework, the main report for which is coming out this spring.
Mm-hmm. What does that stand for, TEEB Agra, the T-E-E-B part?
So the T-E-E-B was the for the economics of ecosystems and biodiversity. And the original study was really focused on environmental considerations and natural capital. So, the basis for which we grow all of our food, you know, how do we build up soils and make sure that we have biodiversity and the pollinators, all of that. So that was the original study, and it was taken up by a lot of businesses, and a whole framework for business was developed, and it sort of turned into what's called the Natural Capital Coalition. There was an interest, though, to dig more deeply into these considerations for food systems. And so it's housed at the United Nations Environment Program, and they started now what's called TEEB for Agriculture and Food, or as we say in short form, TEEB Agri-Food. And so it's really this analysis, taking it beyond environmental considerations into health considerations and social and cultural considerations, looking across the entire value chain of food systems from production through processing and consumption, developing, again, this tool to apply to various stakeholders, processes, production systems, to get a better sense of what the trade-offs are, you know, what the full costs are and how we navigate that to make better decisions about what we grow and how we grow it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I guess one of the things I see as a problem is that even if we recognize that the true cost of a food is much higher because of the health cost implications or the cleaning up of the toxic wastes or any of those kind of things, if the corporations who are producing the food aren't held responsible for paying those costs, there's no incentive to them to bring that cost into view for the public. How is it going to change unless, you know who we have here in our White House. He's not one that's looking out for the people. He's looking out for the corporations. So he's trying to save them the money. I guess I'm a little skeptical as how the true cost, and I've been looking at this, myself, over years, I've had people on talking about true cost analysis. Unless we hold the corporations responsible and make them pay some of those costs, how is it going to impact any change?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, and it's I'm not going to pretend that it's easy or straightforward. I think it's really difficult. We have deeply entrenched systems, and we still have, a whole private sector landscape that is driven by profits. And so, this is a big thorny issue. What I would say, though, is that a number of things. One is that we do need to use this information in policy and legislative matters. And I know that's also very tricky in the U.S. context right now, but if you're looking globally, there are opportunities to shift the political landscape and the policy landscape to support some of these solutions. I would say, secondly, that this information is critically important for the broader sort of group of actors, including civil society, social movements, you know, the real voices for change. You know, this can be a leverage point for them to put pressure on companies and on sort of the private sector interests. And then thirdly, I would just say that, you know, the companies themselves, you know, there are folks within those companies that are also looking for change and are also pushing this kind of within the system. So I think that, again, this information becomes a tool for them to try to push things within their own businesses and organizations. Just an interesting anecdote. We did one of these true cost accounting studies on three farms in the U.S. Where we sort of compared and contrasted. And the interesting thing was one of the farms was a quite conventional soy corn farm in the Mississippi Valley. And the farmer, I think, agreed to do this somewhat begrudgingly because it was kind of like, what does this mean? And what is it going to tell me? And what do I do with the information? And but anyway, he did it. And when the information was presented back to him in terms of the various externalities and impacts of his farm, his first conclusion was, I got to make changes, right? I want to change. I didn't know any of this. Now that I know it, I want to make changes. His second thought was, but I can't because I work within the farm bill in a certain context in the U.S. And so then his third conclusion was, I got to start becoming an advocate for different policies within my country to enable me to farm the way that I think I need to farm. So that's just evidence that with this kind of information, people's minds do shift and they do start thinking about, you know, their role in that system in a different way. So I think there's opportunity and possibility here, not trying to sugarcoat and pretend it's going to be easy. But I do think that it is a tool that we can really use to great effect.
Yeah, that's good. That's a nice story. Thank you for sharing that. Because, you know, you just, you know, sometimes, you know, especially I'm sure you're in the same boat as me, maybe even more so. You just, you've been watching, you know, so much goodwill being, you know, talked about and mobilized and trying to make change, and actually there is, has been change. I mean, you know, over, you know, 50 years when I first became a vegetarian, and not quite 50 years, I'm not that old yet, but, you know, for a long time, watching it change, there has been change. So it just moves very slow, as we know.
Yeah.
But that's a great story, so thank you for sharing that. So let's see. Okay, so why is it so important to understand the health impacts of food system? I mean, I know and you know, but can you share with everybody how those connections are made and how that's going to impact people changing their minds?
The connection to health, we think, is so important and becoming a much more powerful leverage for change as people become more aware of the health impacts of food systems and as they experience the health impacts of food systems. I think we all know people that have been negatively impacted either by the way we grow food or the food that we eat. You know, I'll go back to what you were saying at the beginning of the show around foodborne illness. I mean, there's an example where that really hits home when you have family members that are affected by that. So, you know, essentially, you know, food is the cornerstone of good health, but generally and ironically, our food system isn't delivering health. And so we really need to understand why, since that's a crazy situation to be in, given, you know, our place on this planet and how we've survived over the last millennia. So we commissioned a study, a report in collaboration with something called IPES Food, and IPES stands for the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems. And they drafted a report called Unraveling the Food Health Nexus. It can be found on our website. And essentially, you know, the report came out with some pretty stark findings that are very difficult to ignore. And essentially, those findings are that our food systems are not delivering health. And in fact, people are getting very sick for a number of different reasons. They have five different sort of food impact channels that they've identified as the cause for why people are getting sick. So, for instance, people are getting sick because of unhealthy diets. People are getting sick because of environmental contamination. People are getting sick because of foodborne illness, et cetera. So there are these five channels. And this study kind of surfaces and highlights, you know, the severity of these issues and the costs associated with that. So, for instance, the global costs of obesity are estimated to be $760 billion. You know, diabetes costs, $673 billion globally. I mean, these are massive numbers. And so, you know, it's quite stark in terms of the findings. You know, therefore, you know, where we need to really create change and focus our efforts. The findings are the findings in terms of sheer numbers and impacts, but then it becomes even starker when you connect it to the fact that most of those impacts are felt by the most vulnerable. So we're talking about, you know, poor people, we're talking about children, we're talking about elderly. So, you know, that makes it even more severe. And then you also compound that with things like climate change, poor sanitation, you know, all the other sort of compounding factors around that. And, you know, it paints a pretty depressing picture. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I think we're really starting to understand this and you know, really recognize the need for change. I do a lot of travel. I connect to a lot of different people from around the world. And, you know, you hear ministers of health from, you know, a country in Africa just saying, like, I don't know how we're going to contend with the healthcare costs in this country. Like, you know, it's going to, you know, decimate our economy because these costs are ballooning. So, you know, it's really not to depress your listeners, but it's really to emphasize the severity and the need to make change, and the need to make change quickly.
Right, right. And poverty, right, is
exactly,
you know, one of the roots of hunger. And, you know, and how are we going to address that? Anyway, on that note, let's just take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about how the Global Alliance is addressing some of the issues like GMOs and pesticide and antibiotic use, if you are addressing that. I don't know. So, everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Ruth Richardson from the Global Alliance for the Future of Food. Be right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with Ruth Richardson from the Global Alliance of the Future of Food. And we've been talking about the coalition that she runs globally. And right now we're about to talk about some of the issues that they take up. So, Ruth, can you tell me, do you address some of the issues like GMOs?
Well, yes, we, so I was just mentioning before the break that we have commissioned this paper on the food health nexus. And one of the interesting things that that paper surfaced was many of the negative health impacts that are felt around the world can be traced back to key practices that, you know, people are following, whether you're talking about, you know, small local food systems or large global food systems. There are key practices that are creating a lot of these negative impacts. And so some of those key practices include things like chemical intensive agriculture, concentrated livestock agriculture, ultra processed foods, and deregulated global supply chains. And so in commissioning this report, we were keen to understand, you know, what the source of the problems are and therefore how we start to move towards a different system. you know, movement is taking place. It is slow because it's so connected to political will, to very entrenched systems that are hard to unravel, and the fact that many of these impacts are felt by the poor and the invisible. You know, there are opportunities, I think, to, you know, to shift systems. And the paper uncovers a couple of different levers. One is really understanding the systems connections, so the connections between, for instance, health, poverty, and climate change. A second one, bringing alternatives to light. So where is there positive evidence of sustainable food systems that we can highlight and that we can, you know, show the pathway towards? A third one is really, you know, around the whole area of governance and policy change. Lots of opportunity there. Fourth is really asserting scientific integrity and research as a public good. And so this is, you know, looking at the whole issue of privately funded research and really trying to encourage, you know, research based on public funds. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, five is adopt the precautionary principle, which basically says we know enough. And even though we don't know everything, if there's a certain amount of evidence, then we should show precaution in terms of how we move forward. And choose kind of, you know, the option that has the least harm. So, you know, mm-hmm. these are fairly broad kind of pathways forward. But for us, we think that they're a good basis for further exploration and that they're, you know, sort of options that we can apply in different contexts, because, of course, there'll be different answers if you're going to talk about, you know, rural India versus New York City. So, you know, within each of these areas, we can find really interesting solutions based on, you know, where we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing you said that I think is so important is that you're going to be doing research with public funds because, you know, I don't know if everyone realizes that most of the research and the studies that are done are being paid for by the corporations that that gain a lot from the research going in their favor or in a position to lose a lot if the research isn't. So obviously, you know, how true the research is questionable. So using public money and having people do the research that don't have conflict of interest is really, I think, so important. I mean, when I hear that, you know, all the testing that's been done on GMOs or what have you are being done by corporations like Monsanto and Bayer and, you know, it just doesn't make, you know, DuPont, I mean, it just doesn't make sense that those are the factual studies that our government uses to justify its safety.
Yeah, so. The other thing that connects to research that's really important for Global Alliance members is this whole question of evidence. So a lot of research is based on sort of quote-unquote hard scientific evidence, which, you know, of course, is incredibly important. But it's not the only evidence that's out there. And our members feel very strongly about bringing in sort of a diverse set of evidences to these questions. And that includes like community impacts, you know, what is being felt sort of on the ground in different, you know, constituencies. There are a lot of indigenous communities that have different ways of identifying, you know, impacts and you know, the impacts of food systems on their populations and how they move forward with that. So there's a lot of different things that we can draw on, mm-hmm. and we need to ensure that we're upholding all of that evidence and not just saying it's got to be hard scientific facts.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, our whole country's been a guinea pig because our country approved GMOs before proving its safety, you know, unlike the European Union that, you know, said no to GMOs and then they had to prove that it was maybe okay and then they put it on just with, you know, cautionary labeling. And so as a result, it's not very big over there because they know people won't get it. And so companies like Nestle are very capable of making every product that they make GMO-free. But in our country, we get the GMO variety because we're okay with it here. So they can just look at our society, go back to when GMOs started, and then look at the society and look at what kind of health impacts have changed since the introduction of that. And you can, you know, again, you can't draw hard scientific conclusions, but you can get a sense on the ground of what's going on and draw some conclusions that way as well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's all so interesting. And so how does your organization do fundraising for carrying on some of these expensive research projects?
Yeah, so, we're an alliance of foundations. So foundations typically have either endowments from which they draw, or they have some source of funds from, the benefactors. And so we're in the very privileged position of having available funds to do this kind of research. The way we're organized specifically is that to be a member of the Global Alliance, you put in a contribution. And with that contribution, we're able to, support kind of a nimble infrastructure, sort of the core staff, and that we have funds available to support this kind of work. As we move down the road we increase our ambitions and the scope of our work, there are a lot of other people that are also interested in what it is we're doing. So, for instance, that third area, agroecology, we've been doing some really interesting work around seed systems and resilient seed systems, recognizing that seeds are a cornerstone of, agricultural biodiversity and agroecology. We did a paper on resilient seed systems, sort of a compendium of different views from around the world. We are having a convening in Rome in April that is being hosted by the FAO. It's an international symposium on agroecology. So we'll be doing some events and convenings there. And we're moving towards, a major gathering around this in Oaxaca, Mexico, in the fall, where we want to, with diverse stakeholders, really develop a shared action framework around agroecology and resilient seed systems. And so in doing, this series of, research papers and events, we've heard a lot of other actors within the space interested in that, whether it's some of the bilateral funders like, Norway, Sweden, Canada, we have a lot of sort of bilateral government funders that have been looking at this, or whether it's some of the multilaterals like the UN agencies, but there's a lot of interest. So while we have, our core budget, we also are looking to partner with others who share similar interests.
Okay, so you talked a little bit, you mentioned Beacons of Hope, this report that you're going to be launching later this year. Can you tell us how that's going to show transitions to sustainable food systems that happen both at the local level and the global scale?
Yes, thank you for the question, because it's a really exciting project. The members of the Global Alliance identified this early on as an area of interest, because it's very easy to talk about the problems and where things aren't going well. And we wanted to equally be able to hold up examples of where there are really positive transitions to sustainable food systems happening. So we partnered with the BioVision Foundation, and they undertook a study to identify what we call beacons of hope, or these positive examples of food systems transformation. They identified over 100 different examples around the world. They then chose over 20 to dig in, quite deeply into how they transition, what the factors have been, what the enabling, environment was. And then in this report, they'll really showcase a handful of these beacons, alongside a framework that they'll develop that, will show funders, advocates, policymakers, and others, what the pathways are to sustainable food systems across different contexts and scales. So the idea is that they're very specific examples, but they're things that we can learn, looking across those examples in terms of, conditions need to be in place to support those transitions. So it's a very exciting study. We're going to be workshopping it in the spring, and then we hope to have it finalized later in the summer or early fall. And then maybe I'll just tell you a story about one of the beacons because I just happened to have visited in the last couple of weeks. And one of the beacons of hope is a very ambitious and interesting project that's taking place in a state in India. The state is called Andhra Pradesh, and it's down in the southeast part of India. Population is about 46 million. So it's a very large state. And 90% of people in India are fed by farmers, smallholder farmers that own less than 1 hectare of land. So this state is defined by that same sort of, sort of situation where it's a lot of smallholder farmers. They have these small plots and they're basically feeding the population of the country. So the project is, as I say, a very ambitious project to promote what they're calling zero budget natural farming. So the natural farming piece of it is that it's farming that is based on ecological principles that's totally natural. So, you know, no chemical fertilizers, pesticides, no GMO seeds, et cetera. And the zero budget part of it is that it all comes from within the farming system. So they're not actually buying any of those inputs. They're creating their own compost. They're developing their own pesticides. They have this amazing recipe for a natural pesticide that's basically cow urine, chili peppers, garlic, neem, and tobacco that they kind of ferment, and then it turns into this natural pesticide. So it's a really interesting model. I would say it's not necessarily new because it builds on, you know, sort of traditional practices, et cetera. But what is interesting is the scale at which they're trying to move this across the state. So they started with about 40,000 farmers. They're now up to 180,000 farmers. They are doing this all kind of bottom-up farmer-to-farmer training. And their ambition is to get to 6 million farmers by 2024. And they're doing it through sending out these master farmers to different villages and communities, as well as having training sessions. And I was blown away to learn that the last training session they had attracted 8,000 farmers for 9 days to sort of talk through how you do this, how you transition to it, how you scale it, how you, convert your neighbor.
It's a really fascinating.
Really fascinating project. Yeah, so that is a beacon of hope. And, we're all kind of watching to see how it goes, but it's going incredibly well so far, and there are many things we can learn from that. Now, we might not be able to necessarily translate that model to the United States, but nevertheless, there are certain things that have supported that transition that we can identify, that we can communicate, and that we can translate to other places.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we're seeing that across our country too, that the older, more traditional methods can feed the world. You know, they really, you know, the whole promise we had with GMOs of higher yields and less pesticides, none of that ended up really panning out to be true. It started out looking good, but, 25 years later, it hasn't proven to be the case. So I think, there is hope that we can go back to some of these more traditional ways and feed everybody a better food system. But Ruth, we're just about out of time. So I want to thank you so much for joining us. I will share your information, your website, on my website and in my newsletter with everybody so that they can go on and see what you guys are up to. And are there any events or any place you're going to be speaking in the States that people should know about that I can share on my website?
Nothing on my calendar in the States right now. I've got lots of stuff happening in Europe and Africa and other places. But if you share our website, that would be great.